Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 18 of NML Crossing, where it's a particularly rainy and dark morning here in the Phoenix metro area, which is I guess it's our attempt at having snow, which we don't really get that too often here. So it's wet and it's dismal, but what are you gonna do? Now today we are going to be wrapping up Cataclysm. It was a long story, wasn't it? 18 parts, 19 episodes, including the prologue. It was a long time coming, and it's funny. I look at 18 episodes, and it's a lot, but it's not a lot at the same time. And I remember back to around Thanksgiving last year when I was kind of still on the fence about doing this project. Like I've said before, I wanted to do something. I wasn't sure what. And when I decided I wanted to do No Man's Land and realized I needed so damn many issues to have the complete No Man's Land experience, I says to myself, "Well, self, you got those trades in the room. You got that 5-volume set." And I guess I didn't realize how thin they were. Because when I went and got them, they're very, very thin. Like, I think, I mean, I'm trying to think of what to compare them to, but they are very, very thin. And I think to myself that had we gone that direction, had I just used those five trades, we'd probably be about halfway through at this point. I mean, we're not even sniffing No Man's Land yet, and we're 18 episodes in. Had we gone that way, we'd be, about to the midway point, which I don't know, it's kind of funny to consider. And boy, I'm glad I didn't go at it from that direction. So anyway, all's that to say, today we're wrapping up Cataclysm. We're about to jump into Aftershock, but how about we wrap this one up? Your humble host, who is denser than most, and hey, that rhymes, is going to eat a little bit of crow today. Because I kind of called out creative on the sort of kind of out of nowhere reveals, like I think it was Detective Comics 720 or 721, whichever one we just read, where like Robin came up with an idea and the GCPD came up with an idea and everybody had these ideas and I'm like, how the hell are they coming up with, how are they coming to these conclusions? It just doesn't make sense to me. Well, this is one of those things where when you find out what it is and you look back, some things do stand out to you. And as a, fake ass comics analyst that I am, it's a little embarrassing when you miss some things that are kind of obvious. But yeah, what are you gonna do, right? Let's get into it. Let's get into it. This is Robin, I think we're calling it Volume 2, number 53, May 1998 cover date. The story is Cataclysm Conclusion, Flattened, written by Chuck Dixon with art by Staz Johnson and Stan Wok, or Woke. Letters Tim Harkins, colors Adrian Roy, edits Gorfinkel O'Neill, cover price $1.95. Now, we don't pick up where we left off last episode or even the episode before that. We pick up where we left off at the end of Detective 721. So I guess it was Detective 721 where all those revelations came up. Now, that was 3 episodes ago. And we're still in the midst of that hostage standoff. We got Mac Bock there held at gunpoint while Montoya, Bullock, and Robin make their approach. Now, I mean, I could say something cute like, hey, maybe our techs called a timeout so Harvey can go appear over in Catwoman. Or maybe we just won't think about that, so let's just not go there. The Quakemaster, he's on the monitors demanding the good guys lower their arms, but Robin ain't having it. You see, he claims to know who QM really is. And again, cards on the table. Like I said, I gave this bit of the story some guff for coming out of nowhere, but, well, damn it, there were clues. Now, in fairness to my mental density, the clues were semi-obscure, but they were clues all the same, and I'm supposedly reading this with an analytical eye, so I should have picked up, but I did not. Anyway, Robin calls out the Quakemaster and he dares him to call him by name, like, say my name, say Robin. But he can't. Because, well, damn it, the third letter in Robin is a B. The Quake Master can't or won't say anything with the letter B in it. Huh. Robin then asks Quake Master to say the name of the other half of the dynamic duo, and QM tries to weasel around it by referring to Batman as the Flying Ferret, which isn't near as catchy a name for our guy, is it? Anyway, Quake Master commands his flunkies to start shooting. Before they can, however, Hardbach kicks himself back, knocking himself and the chair he's bound to into the baddies. So it looks as though business is about to pick up. Meanwhile, the Flying Ferret makes friends with a dog. Like, for real. Like, he's out on the streets of Gotham and he happens across a yipping pup. And it's like a total Lassie situation here. Like, Batman's all, what is it, boy? Is someone trapped somewhere? It's, you know, it's silly. The dog leads our hero to some rubble with either a KO'd or dead body laying nearby. Our next stop is City Hall, where those other Quake Master flunkies are about to give the mayor, what's-her-face, Grange? They're about to give her some lead implants. Just then, Nightwing makes his entrance, crashing through a large window. Which might be efficient, but there had to have been a better way. I don't know. Anyway, Dick beats the bejesus out of the geeks without much effort. Like, the situation is literally in hand in 3 panels. Super quick. Back to Batman and the dog. Now, it looks like the body we saw wasn't dead. And they wake up and they tell Rusty, the dog, that he's a good boy. Batman starts digging nearby and he finds 10 folks buried in the basement below. One of them is badly injured. Batman asks if they can climb up, which, I mean, if they could, they probably would have, but I don't know. Now back to the hangar, warehouse, or wherever the action is happening. We got Bullock and Montoya blowing the bad guys to bits. Like, full-on open fire situation here. It's just done deal. The techs then attend to Hardbach, while Robin sneaks around behind the curtain to try and nab the big bad. And here is our reveal. The Quake Master, my friends, is a puppet. And our apparent big bad has his hand right up its butt. It's the ventriloquist. Not one of my favorites, but, you know, a pretty clever reveal all the same. And I suppose it also adds him to our No Man's Land chessboard, doesn't it? Now, this doesn't explain why the Bat Brain Trust couldn't figure out a more universal design for him, or it, or whatever, the puppet. You know, it looked different, like, almost in every panel. And I'm not seeing, like, a fleet of slightly different puppets here, so I'm guessing it was just a miscommunication, or different styles, I guess we can say. Anyway, the ventriloquist pulls a gun on our boy Wonder, but gets a ring hurled at him before he can fire off a shot. The Quake Master puppet gets nailed and falls to the floor. Just then, Bach bursts into the room and is nearly shot himself, if not for Robin tackling him out of the way. Now, amid this confusion, the ventriloquist retrieves an old pal from a nearby trunk, and it's Scarface, who promises to show everyone how to really rock this town. Back to Batman. Now, he passes some food, water, and first aid equipment down to the trapped survivors. Now, they don't know that it's Batman helping them out. After all, there ain't no such thing as a Batman. Now, while our hero celebrates with his canine sidekick, some rubble collapses on top of him. A Batman that is rusty, the Wonder Dog is thankfully unscathed. Let's jump back to Dick. Now, he's chasing the last flunky out of the mayor's office. Now, they take turns slamming each other into a wall, which causes the already structurally compromised building to begin to rumble and sway. Hop back to the detectives. Harvey and Renee discover the locked-away Jojo Relazzo. Now, she introduces herself as the puppet guy's hostage, and seems to have a real thing for old Bullock. She thinks he's very, very handsome. So, old Harv's getting lucky left and right these last few chapters, isn't he? Back to Robin. He and Bach are given chase to our big bad, and they reach a train yard. But not just any train yard, this one is an electrified train yard. Now, they're followed onto the scene by some more flunkies, and I gotta ask here, how many friggin' flunkies does a ventriloquist have? They just keep popping up. It's ridiculous. Anyway, now this gaggle of goofs winds up electrocuted. Robin and Bach aren't sure how they'll reach the big bad without winding up crispy critters themselves. Back to Nightwing. Now he picks the last flunky up in like a fireman's carry, and then together they burst through yet another window to the outside. And as they plummet, or I guess gracefully fall from this giant building, the place looks like it's in the midst of crumbling. So I guess we gotta hope that the mayor and the commish got out okay. Alright, now back with Bachman and Robin. Bach takes aim and, he blows Scarface's wooden brains out. The ventriloquist then falls to his knees and begs the heroes to go find a doctor for his, smoking and smoldering glove critter. Back to Batman. Now he spends a page pulling himself up out of the rubble and getting his face licked by Rusty the Wonder Pup. Just then, emergency services arrive and Batman makes himself scarce. During the dig out, an officer discovers the tattered and seemingly mile-long cape of Batman. Now, Batman lost his cape while crawling out of the wreckage. Now, this officer doesn't know what to make of it because, again, there ain't no such thing as a Batman. From here, we jump over to Oracle as she tries to make contact with Wayne Manor. Alfred is there to answer the call. In the background, we see good old Harold reconnecting some wires in the ceiling, so I guess the repairs are at least sort of kind of underway. Now, Alfie tells Babs that the boys are headed back home, which tells him that the Quake Master is donezo and that this adventure is over. To which Babs is all, yep, till the next one. From here, we head into our wrap-up, and we see some pan-over shots of the decimated and rubble-fied Gotham City. Normalcy, such as it was, is but a memory. The skyline's shot, bridges are down, neighborhoods are nothing. The rebuild, they say, will take years, and even then, it'll never be the same. We close out with Batman and his boys' wonder atop a tower, or spire of some sort, probably a Wayne-owned one since it's still standing, and there they discuss the tremendous loss that Gotham faced in the wake of the cataclysm. It's said that there's over 100,000 deaths, and that there are Blackgate escapees all over the place. Batman kind of sighs and says, well, at least it's over. But this thought is interrupted by an aftershock, which, my friends, is exactly where we are headed. But that's all for now. Next time, we will be kicking off the aftershock era in the landmark 75th issue of Shadow of the Bat. But of course, before we do that, we gotta do this. Let's talk about the wrap-up to Cataclysm, and, there we have it, right? And boy, like I alluded to at the start here, did I whiff on the Quake Master clues, huh? And I mean, I always say I am a dense dude. Looking back on the hints that were given, off the top of my head, there are a couple that stand out as being kinda damning evidence that our Big Bad was a puppet. You know, there was the fact that Mo and Dunk, those flunkies, they said that they thought there were two Quake Masters, but only one of them actually spoke. I mean, you see two silhouettes right next to each other. One of them speaks, one doesn't. Sure, that could be the ventriloquist. Perhaps the most damning is Robin's research and his acknowledgement that, there were certain, more obvious words and phrases that Quakey wasn't using and he wouldn't say. But instead he would, pause to summon up his inner B-less thesaurus. And, if I were even more anal than I actually am, and hadn't already filed away the past dozen or so issues, I might be tempted to go back with a more, zeroed-in laser focus to see if there were any times where creative slipped up and let Quake Master utter a word with the letter B in it. Thankfully for all of us, I'll just kind of let it be. No pun intended, I guess. Let it be. I'll probably continue referring to how, for a puppet, the creative teams couldn't seem to agree on what it looked like. On that note, I do wonder where the Quake Master puppet wound up. I feel like it could have been a really fun trophy for the Batcave once the rebuild happens. Does anybody know if it's ever made an appearance anywhere after this? Unfortunately, the DC Wiki isn't being all that helpful as it pertains to the Quake Master. It just goes right back to ventriloquist stuff. Now, having already dipped my toe into the Aftershock era, we are a couple of scripts ahead. I try to be a few scripts ahead as I record things, just in case anything comes up. I do feel like this issue is a perfect sort of bridging chapter. If we take Batman, for example, he's spending all of his time helping Gotham citizens dig themselves out, which is pretty much what he's going to be busy doing moving forward for the next little bit. So I do like that while this is an ending, and we are drawing a line under the Cataclysm era, there is some bridging. You know, we're already moving forward here. Batman's already in the next phase where he is, you know, literally pounding pavement to try to help people out. Speaking of survivors, Jolene Relazzo survives the arc, which is kind of bittersweet as this is apparently her penultimate appearance. We will only see her one more time. We'll see her again in Shadow of the Bat 78, which, if my math and roadmap are correct, we'll be talking about in episode 28. So, in an ideal world, exactly 2 weeks from today. Now, I think the only part of this issue I really didn't care for were probably the Nightwing bits. And that's odd, because Nightwing is usually the highlight of whatever book he's in for me. But here, I don't know, it felt kind of like a loose end, you know, like just a bit of tacked on action for the sake of it. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, but it just, I think it took more from the story than it gave. You know, I think I would have rather seen more of Robin and the Ventriloquist and more of Batman, you know, being Batman. Plus, that Nightwing, the Nightwing cutaways here, the flow was sort of all over the place. And again, I know I'm not the best at following stories all the time, but I actually had to reread these pages because, honestly, I couldn't tell whether Dick was coming or going. And I just realized how disgusting that sentence sounded. overall, this was a neat issue, wrapped up Cataclysm quite nicely, and almost shockingly quick, you know? I still have my, you know, current year goggles on sometimes when I read these older issues, and I feel like it's been a long time since we've gotten an ending like this, where, you know, we have a final chapter of a cross-event sort of story, and in it, the mysterious villain's revealed and beaten, and we get a feeling of semi-closure. Like, of course, the quake still happened. Gotham is still post-apocalyptic, contagion pun not intended, but the use and defeat of old Wesker as the big bad of the arc made it feel like a more complete story. Does that make sense? Like it made it episodic in a way where, like, the episode actually ends and we're on to the next thing. Like, nowadays, and I'm pleading a bit of ignorance here because it's been a minute since I've read an event. I buy them all because I'm an idiot, but it's been a minute since I've actually read one beginning to end. But I feel like a lot of the big events that I've read recently or in recent years, they always seem to end with something along the lines of a the beginning blurb rather than a the end, you know? Where it's like you feel like you've invested all this time and energy reading something and it's like you're not even there yet. With Cataclysm, I feel like we do get a full story. Sure, of course, there is reason to return for Aftershock and beyond. But when you finish this issue, I feel like you're walking away having been given a complete and mostly linear story. So as an issue, good. As an arc, good. I mean, a lot of good stuff with some great stuff in there as well. And, I mean, last word, I'm definitely glad I finally took the time to read this. Now, before we cut out of here, let's hop into the NML bag here. We're going to start with our friend Eric, who's talking about Azrael and some thoughts about Azrael and Denny O'Neil and some of the stuff that Denny had said about the Azrael character. Now, Eric says, I don't remember where I read this, but it may have been in one of Denny's journals or in some interview. But I recall reading that Denny O'Neil never anticipated for Azrael to have his own series or to become a hero. He claims that he was always supposed to be a villain and that after Nightfall, when DC insisted on giving Azrael his own series, that Denny had to make him a more sympathetic character and change some origin details, which he found difficult because, again, he was never supposed to become a hero. And I tell you, that makes a ton of sense. I haven't read that interview. I'll try to track it down for future for some future discussion, but I mean, what Asriel showed up in 92, 93, as Nightfall was 93, and there must have been something in the water in the industry at that point, because that's when we started to try to turn bad guys into good guys, or at least giving bad guys their own ongoings. I remember, how many times did they try with Venom? You know, and Venom was a hot character, but we were getting like barraged with miniseries for Venom, right? I mean, didn't they give like Sabretooth miniseries at this point too? It was a weird time. I mean, it's odd to say that now, since, like, I think I try going through like the DC Connect, like the DC Previews magazine that comes out every month, and I'm shocked to see all the villains that have their own, like, long-running ongoings, like, relatively speaking, of course. But, like, I opened one the other day, and it's, like, Poison Ivy number 21. It's like, they're... what? I just can't wrap my mind around there being an audience for that. Like, I think Penguin has a book that's up to, like, issue 15. So I don't know. I don't understand it. But back in the early mid-90s, it started to become, I guess, fashionable to either just put a spotlight on the villains or try to, like, rehabilitate them. Like, I'll never forget, you know, before the internet was what the internet was, like, your comics character Wikipedia page was a trading card, you know? And I'll never forget, like, seeing, like, the X-Men team card with Sabretooth on it. It's, and like, he was never officially on there, but in the trading card, he was like there for the class portrait. It's just so bizarre. But I could definitely see DC's marketing and brass being like, hey, you know, we got this character. He's kind of hot now, you know. He took over for Batman and there's some buzz. Let's try to capitalize. How that somehow wound up being like 100 issues, I don't understand. But yeah, I can definitely see the challenge laid at Denny's feet there with make this character work, whether you want to or not. Now, Eric continues. He says, personally, over the years, the better Asriel stories are when he's at odds with Batman. They work together well, but it's always better when Asriel is not trying to get on Batman's good side. I'm also surprised his series lasted so long because I found it to be very boring and just retreads of the same story plots of Asriel being upset and confused about whether he wants to be hero or villain. And yeah, we only read one issue so far for this series, and that was Asriel 40. And in it, Bane kept trying to appeal to Asriel and tried to remind him how Batman cast him aside and ignores him and just doesn't value him as an ally or as a peer or as a friend. And I felt like that was the strongest part of that story. But, I mean, you can't do that every issue, you know? And I feel like maybe that's what they had to do to try to make Asriel interesting. If you guys have listened to anything I've talked about on the air, you'll know that I am a Usenet fiend. I go through the old Usenet stuff often, relatively often. I just love getting, you know, the gestalt of what we're reading, and what we're covering, what we're analyzing and discussing. So I will go back to the old Usenet posts and just see what the comic fan of the day thought. You know, their fresh and raw opinions on a book without hindsight. And a lot of them echo what Eric's saying here, where Asriel is, or was, a boring book and very two-dimensional, or maybe even one-dimensional. It was just the same stuff over and over again. And I mean, Eric continues here. He says, the series basically just brings everything back from Nightfall and his miniseries, Sword of Asriel, and had him battle it all again, just not as Batman. So I feel like, yeah, there probably was a lot of retread there, and there's really only so many times you can dip back into the same well, you know. Eric continues, you said you were reading Contagion and No Man's Land, so I figured I'd mention this before I forget, or maybe down the road you come across an article or interview of Denny O'Neil commenting on the Asriel series. And it's funny, I am reading Contagion here. I am also writing scripts for it. I don't know what it's going to be. I really don't know if or what it's going to be. So far, I'm really, really enjoying it. I had read Contagion probably... probably turn of the century. That's when I was buying these trades. So I do have a rather thin Contagion trade. It's not all-inclusive, but I did read it ages ago. Don't remember a lick of it. But I am reading it again, and don't know what we're going to do with it, if anything at all. Maybe I'll make them, like, YouTube exclusives, so get some eyes over there. I toyed with maybe using them to relaunch some sort of a Patreon, but I don't know. I mean, what's that saying? I'm not superstitious, but I'm a little stitious. And we tried doing Patreon-type stuff for this feed 3 times. And each of those 3 times, something very, very terrible happened in real life. So I don't know, you know, causation, correlation, anything like that, but I'm a little I'm a little nervous about doing anything like that again. There still is a Patreon that I go into every month to pause the billing cycle on, so nobody gets charged for it since I'm not doing anything, and it still has a surprising amount of support. Some really, really great people who care a lot. Some very, very, very good people. But I don't know what we'll do with Contagion. Worth noting that since we're talking about Contagion and Azrael, the opening chapter of that story features Azrael reporting something into Batman, and Batman brushes him off. Like, he actually says, "What's this got to do with me?" And like, when Azrael goes to explain, he's like, "So what?" It's interesting. It's very interesting to see. Now back to Eric for his wrap-up here. He says, "The Wizard article and other creator comments around the time of No Man's Land are very interesting. Thank you for reading the No Man's Land Wizard info about the Gotham map. I feel it's a good addition to the episodes. I'll talk to you soon." Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Anytime I get too deep into the weeds with the ephemera, I worry that it's a turnoff to most people, because one thing I've learned over the years is the things I find interesting, not many people find interesting. I tend to romanticize things, I suppose, is maybe a proper way of saying it, but I tend to project a lot of importance onto more obscure things that, at the end of the day, don't matter. Because even that map, which was a lot of fun to go through, I recently found my Gotham City Secret File and Origins that came out in, I think, 2001, so post No Man's Land. And there's a map there, and it looks nothing like the one we covered in Wizard. So, who knows? Who knows? It was fun all the same. I'm glad you enjoyed it, and I hope other people did as well. It's a lot of fun for me to, you know, add those extra bits of flavor. Thank you so much for writing in, Eric. I always enjoy hearing from you. Now, another person I really enjoy hearing from is Chris Yu over at the Chris's on Infinite Earths blog. He wrote in, and he's catching up on the show, so we have a lot of great discussion to catch up on with him. Now, regarding the episode with Batman 553, I don't remember the number, but in that one I talked about, you know, I've been talking a lot about diving into the bins. Probably too much, but hey, you know, what you're passionate about, you're passionate about. What you find fun, you find fun. Chris Yu says, "I used to love finding comic shops in different cities when I traveled. Taking out that double-sided loose-leaf sheet with all the back issues I wanted on it, rifling through unknown back-issue bins, good times and exciting memories of exploration." And this is something that non-comics fans will never understand. You know, but collectors will. You know, broadly speaking, collectors will get this. But like, when you discover a new shop, or when one of the shops you go to buys a collection, and suddenly there's these new long boxes out, and, you know, of course, there's going to be the standbys that are always there, but there's always that, like, little flame that's, you know, pushing you forward. It's exciting, you know, it's different. It's, you're going through, you're in, like, unknown territory. And I think, as, you know, comics shoppers, comics collectors, local comic retail supporters, we kind of get comfortable. And like, we know the lay of the land at our shops, and we know what they probably have and what they probably don't, and we've been through the bins hundreds of times before. And then when you find a new one, or if you're, you know, if you're in a foreign town and you're in a new comic shop you've never set foot in before, and you probably never will again, and you got to make the visit count, it's a blast, you know. I love the loose leaf sheet. I used to have a pocket full of index cards before smartphones became a thing, and I must have looked like a lunatic rifling through these cards as I'm digging through bins. And it's such good times. Like I said, it's a broad collecting sort of phenomenon. My wife is into vinyl. She loves collecting vinyl, and when we happen across a new record shop, it's like that I can see in her eyes the same thing that's in mine when I discover a new comic shop. It's the unknown, the new, the what might they have that I missed. It's really cool stuff. Definitely a universal collecting phenomenon that just brings a lot of joy, doesn't it? Back to Chris. He says, I actually liked that the other heroes stayed out of this story. The JLA would have the whole disaster cleaned up in like a week or two. Where's the drama in that? This storyline felt self-contained and in its own universe in that only the Bat characters are involved. The greater DC universe need not be involved. The lack of other heroes made it feel like a movie plot, where, before cinematic universes, only one hero was involved in the story. And I agree 100%. I do. I of course, it's wise to leave the heavy hitters of the DC universe out of this if we want to fully explore this new lay of the land for Gotham and just what it means for the people in the city and the heroes that protect it. Superman and the gang could come in and just do whatever and fix everything up and make everything great, or relatively speaking, of course. And of course, that would cost us a lot of drama. It would cost us a lot of story, and it would fundamentally change a lot of things. But it's like this, you know, the pedantic jerk in the back of my mind here, the lizard brain, you know, it's always engaged in asking those questions because it does feel like it's in its own universe. I think I described it as like the Age of Apocalypse in canon. You know, it's not a different universe. It's not a different world. It's not a different timeline. It's the real timeline, but it's this self-contained world and universe unto itself. And I definitely prefer it that it just be a Bat story, but I don't know. It's like, it's silly. Because like we see people in Gotham City making comments that they really ought not be making, you know, like them saying like, oh, the Batman's as real as like space aliens. And it's like, you live in the DC universe. We've got, you know, Dick Grayson saying like, well, if Atlantis ever existed, it's like, dude, you live in the DC universe. Those things do exist here. You know, this isn't the real world. I don't know. There's that weird disconnect. It kind of reminds me of how, like, they revealed, this is going back to X-Lapsed, but they revealed that, like, Cyclops died and came back from the dead. And that was, like, the smoking gun that mutants can resurrect. And I'm sitting here thinking, like, superheroes die and come back every single day in Marvel. Why is this Cyclops one any different? You know, I don't know. That weird disconnect, I get hooked up on it. What can I say? I'm a very simple man. I don't know. And sorry about that sound there. I was going to edit that out, but something fell off my table. And since we're about to go into Chris's second message here, I want to leave that in because, it's oddly and coincidentally something he's going to mention in this message. So his next one is regarding Azrael number 40. And he says, Azrael defeating Bane was the glue that defined Azrael as the new Batman during Nightfall. So seeing Azrael defeat a Bane who's not on the Venom drug makes total sense to me. It's like Azrael has got Bane's number and he knows exactly how to beat him. And yeah, that's true. That is true. I will give you that for sure. He can beat the, you know, Venom mad Bane. And so it would stand to reason that he'd be able to beat our, you know, garden variety Bane. it just to me felt like he was being jobbed out. It was so quick. It didn't seem like it took much effort. Though, I you know, if Azrael is the answer to Bane, I guess it would make sense. He continues, I only ever bought Azrael number one, and then any issue involved in a Batline crossover, and then finally the last issue for a definitive ending to the volume. And, well, if I were a betting man, and I'm not, but if I were a betting man, I would bet that most people have that as their Azrael collection as well. I know personally that's what I've got. I mean, I had to actually go out and find these No Man's Land ones because I didn't have those, but I did have like the first issue of Azrael that I found in a quarter bin somewhere. I might have had another sprinkling that I found in a quarter bin, and then it was like the Joker Last Laugh, maybe a Bruce Wayne Murderer Fugitive one if there was a tie in there. I know I don't have very many. I still don't have very many, even with all the No Man's Land stuff. Because, you know, just like our friend Eric and our friends on Usenet said, it's a boring book. There's just not a whole heck of a lot to it. I guess it is what it is. I mean, I don't know if there are any Azrael fanatics out there. And not just for the character, but for the actual 100-issue series. If you are, I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to get some recommendations. Tell me what to check out that might change my mind a bit. Now, back to Chris. He says, this is about how we organize our collections, which is a big thing for me. I enjoy hearing about that. I enjoy learning and even, you know, thinking about changing the way I do things to make things work better. Now, he says, I used to sort my collection by amount. Whichever series I had the most issues of was first, and then the most issues on, and so on, and so on. Canceled series were separate from ongoing series. Complete canceled series were separate from canceled series without all issues of the series. Limited series were separate but still in order of most issues, then alphabetical amongst the series with the same amount of issues. And then finally one-shots, they were separate but left alphabetical. And he says, thankfully I had a map to tell me what was where. The guy who bought my collection wouldn't take it without the map. He said it was too confusing without it. I don't know, I knew where everything was. And that sound you heard a few minutes ago was my map falling off my table. I put together a map probably 2 years ago when we were moving house. I was able to take advantage of the fact that we had an empty house for, well, hell, the house is still empty. We are in limbo as far as where we're going to live. It's another part of it's another piece of the 2023 puzzle that wasn't ideal. But I took advantage of the fact that we had an empty house, and I took over it. I took it over with my long boxes, you know? Something like 110 long boxes strewn throughout the dining room, kitchen, living room, den, just boxes everywhere. And when I was doing that, I also put together this roadmap that I have next to me here. And page one is my Batman boxes, and it's definitely come in handy, especially when starting this project, because I had trouble finding the Robin box. I've got Robin and I think Red Hood together in a box, and I couldn't find the damn thing. So I had to refer to my map and then start digging. You see, when I set up the room that I'm currently operating out of, we were, you know, eyeball deep and X-lapsed. So, like, I've got over 100 long boxes in this room with me now, and on the top of each stack is an X-Men box, because I had to be able to get to those more often than the others. So everything else was kind of just wherever. It didn't matter, because I wasn't planning on doing anything with those, except for eventually filing stuff away that I came across. But the X-Men boxes they still are mostly on top. But I've got Bat books and Titan books just everywhere. The map might not actually be as useful as it once was. It's kind of a disaster in here. But I definitely want to thank Chris for sharing his organizational strategy and his methods and whatnot. And I, of course, would love to keep that question open to everyone else here. How do you guys organize? Do you have a map? Do you have a map that... Here's the question. Do you have a map that would be decipherable by people who aren't you? because, Chris mentioned that he sold his collection to someone with the map. So I have to assume that it was something they could follow and understand. I'm looking at mine right now, and I don't know, you ever watch It's Always Sunny? And you see like how Charlie will write notes that are, borderline illiterate and are symbols and hieroglyphs, basically. That's kind of how my map looks. Like, if I were to hand this to my wife right now, she wouldn't have the foggiest idea what she's looking at. So do you have a map, and is it legible? Is it readable by other people, the uninitiated? I'd like to hear all about that. But big thanks to Chris for writing in and sharing his thoughts and for keeping up with the show. And of course, again, if anybody out there would like to join the conversation, I encourage and invite you to do so. We could talk about anything and everything. You can find me several different ways. WeirdComicsHistory@gmail.com, ChrisIsOnInfiniteEarths.com, GothamQuake.com, 90s X-Men on Facebook, Ace Comics on Twitter, and I opened a Blue Sky. I didn't know what a Blue Sky was. My buddy Dave mentioned it to me. And then Chris Bailey, Charlton Hero, sent me an invite to make an account. And I basically just did to squat the Ace Comics name. So I did that. It looks a lot like Twitter. Don't know that I need another Twitter. I don't know that I need one Twitter. But it's there now. And if you want to follow, it's Ace Comics on Blue Sky, I guess. But with all that out of the way, I would like to thank you all so much for sharing your ears with me today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Starting over when the story's got an astounding twist.